Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and we're here with Jared Bernstein, who's the Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and former Chief Economist to Vice President Joe Biden. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Jared, we have you here for a special reason, which is that this has been a big week in poverty. It's actually been all over the news, and that's in large part because Speaker Paul Ryan unveiled earlier this week a long-awaited, long-anticipated big poverty plan, a whole 35 pages of it. And how was that received, and what was in it?
Well, I recently wrote about an earlier version of this kind of thing by Paul Ryan under the title of a lot of talk with a little walk, meaning that there's not a lot of substance here. And what I really kind of see him and his colleagues doing is just using this word poverty to suggest that they care about people that historically, especially in their budgets, they've really shortchanged. So it's really up to people like us, and I appreciate the chance to do so, to get underneath the surface, to look in those 35 pages, and see if there's any there, if there's any substance. And unfortunately, not only is there very little in the by way of substance, but some of the substance that is there goes the wrong way and would actually increase poverty. So I guess you could say that it's good that they're talking about poverty because it's such a serious problem in America, but the agenda is actually one that would I would consider more dangerous than helpful.
So to dive in a bit about some of the specifics of the plan, one of the things that's probably not surprising to anyone who's been following these sorts of developments, especially Ryan's work over the past couple of years,
which would include all of our listeners
yeah, who just love reading about Paul Ryan's plans, is that he expands the amount of work requirements. So work requirements for SNAP, strengthening the work requirements for TANF. I think a lot of people would maybe on first blush think, well, you know, you should try to work. But why is this problematic? Can you break down?
Yeah, I think Paul Ryan and a lot of his the folks that work on poverty with him labor under a very serious misperception that welfare reform was a resounding success and that it should be repeated in the area of SNAP or food stamps and housing and any place else it can. I mean, if you understand that, you understand a little bit more of their motivation.
And by welfare reform, you're referring to the 1996 welfare law that converted aid to families with dependent children into the TANF block grant, temporary assistance for needy
families.
Exactly.
So that's what I mean by welfare reform. And and when that occurred, the job market happened to be very strong at that time. The EITC was increased, the minimum wage was increased, and there's no question that pushing a number of single moms into the job market led them to find work in this very strong demand-oriented economy. However, if you then track the success of welfare reform, this mid-90s change that we were just that you just took us through, you'll see that over the long term, it was not nearly the kind of success that looms in the minds of Republicans like Paul Ryan. For example, deep poverty has gotten much worse because for people who face barriers to employment, or for that matter, in a job market that's not as strong as the latter 90s, which we haven't had such a strong job market since, people find that not only can they not get the work that they need or not get enough work, but their benefits fall significantly. TANF is still funded because of the block grant that was implemented in 96 at the same level it was back then, 20 years ago. And that's obviously problematic because the population has grown. And so this notion that you can just block grant a funding stream to states, because that's really what it is, and somehow magically people find jobs and poverty goes away, has been very much disproved by subsequent events, and yet they've not learned that lesson.
It also strikes me that a conversation about poverty and or a 35-page document that purports to be the solution to poverty that has no mention of strategies to create jobs or to raise wages when a lot of, I don't know that Paul Ryan would see it this way, but a lot of what poverty in America really is about the fact that wages have stagnated and declined. Is that to you maybe one of the more notable absences?
Yeah, I think there's nothing in here about the minimum wage. So for example, the minimum wage at the federal level is still set at $7.25 an hour. Anyone listening to my voice probably knows that that doesn't work for working people. Now, there are many states that have taken their own actions. And of course, there's the Fight for 15, which is, I think, a very progressive approach to anti-poverty. But that's precisely the kind of thing that you're suggesting here. And it is an egregious oversight that you've seen under that. But it's not, again, it's not surprising because the underlying assumption, again, born of a very mistaken understanding of what happened with TANF back in the 90s, the underlying assumption is what's standing between a poor person and prosperity is not the absence of a job, it's not a low minimum, it's that they don't want to get a job.
Right.
So the underlying philosophy is if you want a good job, you can get a good job. Now, anyone who's ever worked with the poor, I was formerly a social worker, or has spent some time in poor neighborhoods, know that's not the case. Right. It leaves out institutional racism. It leaves out the absence of full employment. It leaves out wage policies. So it's just a very naive, wishful thinking approach to the problem.
So I'm going to ask you to do an impossible task, maybe a hard task, but to get into Paul Ryan's brain for a minute. Mm-hmm. And so
not just impossible, undesirable.
Undesirable task. We're walking in shoes for a minute here. So obviously, you know, the conservatives will talk about the need to create more jobs. Mm-hmm. They seem to understand this. They seem to understand many of these things. They've even talked about, I think it was Paul Ryan gave a speech and he said that we need higher wages,
but we need to push wages up.
We need to push wages up was the quote, which is obviously, you know, would be about raising the minimum wage, but he doesn't want to say that. So they seem to understand pieces of what you laid out, but what is blocking them from actually making these connections?
I think I can kind of do that in a way. I can put myself in his mindset because from what I can tell, and I try to be, pretty agnostic about what goes on inside people's heads, you know, as an economist more than a psychologist or something. But I do think that there's a really fundamental problem, and I see it all the time. And by the way, their budget is a great example of this, so we should get to that. I think that Paul Ryan probably really wants to reduce poverty, but he doesn't know how. And he has a model. He and his colleagues walk around with a model of the economy that is looks really nothing like what the actual economy looks like. And in that model, all you have to do to get a good job is to want a good job. Yeah. And all of the programs that we can demonstrably show you through extensive and careful research actually do help people get out of poverty. They don't, in their mindset. They don't work. So they're constantly saying we fought a war on poverty and it's a stalemate or something, even though there's tons of evidence to the contrary. I mean, the EITC, food stamps, these housing programs, not only do they work in terms of helping to alleviate immediate consumption problems of the poor, but we now know that they have positive long-lasting effects. That's inadmissible to the model. So you're walking around, it's as if, you know, we're sitting at a table with chairs. It's as if I don't believe that this is a table or those are chairs. It's going to be very hard for me to have a conversation with you or explain reality if my model of the world looks nothing like the real world. So you have to write a 35-page report that really doesn't say, it's pretty much a nothing burger. And that's because you have really got nothing to say, because your view of how the world works isn't how the world works. And I think that's a real problem. And by the way, one of the best places to see that is in their budget.
Yeah.
So they talk about how we have to help poor people get out of poverty, and then they propose cutting $3.7 trillion in spending, about 40% of which cuts programs for low-income people. So they talk about the importance of skills and education. Well, even they would recognize that people don't pay for their own skills in education. That's a public good. And if you undermine that public good, then it ain't going to happen. So it's this non-reality that I think is hugely cognitively dissonant for them. But if you just kind of live in their insulated world, that maybe doesn't bother you that much.
Well, I have to say, you're not just in Paul Ryan's head, you're also in my head, because I was actually going to suggest that the episode title be Nothing Burger. So I've now locked us up into that. We're going to be doing that. But I have to say, you know, continuing sort of where good intentions might go awry, it was notable that Paul Ryan gave this speech at a drug rehab center, right? And Congresswoman Gwen Moore, when she was actually speaking at an event at the Center for American Progress, at the same time while he was giving that speech, she pointed that out. And she said, you know, Paul Ryan views poor people as broken people. What he doesn't understand is that they're people living in a broken economy that's only working for those at the top of the income ladder and not the rest of us. Is a piece of where the breakdown happens between potentially good intentions and horrible policies, a total lack of desire to confront the fact that it's actually structural economic problems and not individual failures that drive poverty.
I really think you're saying very much what I was saying a second ago. Again, it's a model of this market-driven economy where market failures don't occur, right? So the market works perfectly well. And if you want a good job that will lift you and your family out of poverty, you'll get a good job. And we have to, if we somehow wish upon a star, wages will go up. If the issues of discrimination or being stuck in a neighborhood without jobs, the fact that employment is has been just not for the poorest people, has been a tough slog for middle class people as well over the last few decades. You can look at the median wage. You don't have to go all the way down to the bottom and see real flatness there. In fact, interestingly, lately, low wages have been doing better than median wages. Why? Because we've raised minimum wages. Mm-hmm, right. So if your model of the pristine marketplace is such that it doesn't admit any of these market failures, of which poverty is a very central one, then yeah, I think that you're going to look at any person who doesn't fit into that market economy as essentially broken. They're not doing their part. If they stepped up and entered this great merry-go-round of uplifting market forces, all would be well.
It's just easier to call poor people untapped, dormant assets, which actually got said at the unveiling of that plan.
Untapped, dormant assets.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's perfect. That's perfect. That fits right into this. And again, you have to extend the analysis. If you believe this untapped dormant asset business,
which is almost
UDAs,
I was going to say it's the new ABOD, right?
Yeah. If you believe in UDAs, if that's your model of the universe, and that all people have to do is step up, then cutting the budget by $4 trillion is actually not a problem at all,
right?
Because these programs don't help anybody. All you have to do, if you're an untapped dormant asset, if you're a UDA, is step up.
You're legitimizing it now.
Yeah.
You've said it three times.
I think we should reclaim it, actually.
Yeah.
It's time. There's a hashtag here.
So and then, by the way, let's complete the model. So you cut spending by $3.7 trillion because it doesn't matter anyway. It's just up to people to lift themselves up by their bootstraps. What do you do with that? Well, then you cut taxes for rich people. And there
That's
the model
right.
closes.
That's right.
Remember, Paul
right.
Ryan and his colleagues, at the end of the day, they're about cutting taxes
right.
for their funder base.
That's right.
Right. So you really you can't look at this stuff in isolation.
Right. So we've talked a lot about what's problematic in Ryan's plan. And I think there's a lot of things that we would have put in a poverty plan that didn't appear in there. And you had some.
It's funny you should say that, Tracy.
So, you know, we actually released a plan this week. And you had.
Did you? I hadn't heard about that.
I was gonna say, you had some kind words to say about it in the Washington Post. But, you know, it's a collection and compilation of a lot of policies that we've promoted and that some of our partners have backed and promoted in their own right. What are some proactive things that you think that we should be doing to fight poverty, particularly as, you know, we're in the midst of an election season, that this is an opportunity to get candidates to include these issues on their platform?
Well, there are many things in your report that I would put under that rubric. I think what was most important is that pretty much everything in there was kind of battle tested. So there's two ways to approach this. One is you can apply the kind of wishful thinking that we've been talking about and a model that doesn't really correspond to reality, or you can look at, you know, reams of research, decades of research that show you how things work or not. You suggest extending some of the refundable tax credits, both the EITC and earned income tax credit and the child tax credit. Those have been proved, again, not just to help people in the now, today, but when we follow kids who've benefited from those programs relative to ones that haven't, we see better outcomes down the road. And that suggests we're not just talking about consumption, we're talking about investment. And one of the problems we've had in an increasing inequality economy is that low-income people haven't been able to invest in their children the way high-income people have. That's a serious problem. One of the other really important things in there, in the same spirit of investing in kids, is, of course, quality pre-K. Quality preschool for children, you know, that should be a bipartisan supported idea because, again, it has a really big bang for the buck in terms of later payback. I thought your an idea that I really liked, in fact, I think you may have stolen this from me, is this idea of a job creation fund. I don't remember exactly what you call it, but the idea is that in the great recession, when I was working for the Obama administration, we had a TANF emergency jobs fund. These were subsidized employment, where jobs are subsidized to the tune of 80 or 90% of the worker's paycheck, and we ended up with 260,000 jobs being created in a very weak economy that helped low-income people, and it's temporary. And one of the things that you find if you follow these folks is that for many of them, it's the kind of entree in the job market that they need. And so I think an ongoing employment fund that could kick up in a countercyclical way in downturns, but would also be relevant in difficult neighborhoods, even in better economies. I like that idea too.
Another, I'm tempted now to keep up with the UDA's business, right? We could rename Paul Ryan's plan A Better Way for UDA's. Right? All right, I'll stop.
I've already forgotten what it stands for, so but keep
untapped
going.
Untapped dormant assets.
Oh, yeah,
we're not
right.
going to let
yeah,
that
doesn't,
this
that
down.
Doesn't really no, flow.
No,
yeah.
it's not really human there, you know. But another topic that you and sort of set of policies that you have really been out there loudly calling for a long time, and where I think we're sort of in each other's heads on this one, is about has to do with how many people in this country have criminal records. That we're at a point where 1 in 3 American adults now has some type of criminal record. That can, of course, be a life sentence in many ways to joblessness and poverty, not just for the individual with the record, but also for their family. CAP has done some work finding that nearly half of American kids now have a parent with a criminal record. What are some of the policy solutions there?
Well, first of all, let me say that that gets a mention in the Ryan report. But as far as I could tell, the solution was more school choice or something like that. And, you know, that is a good example of how, again, if your model doesn't entail this kind of a market failure, where clearly, I mean, you've already got a significant discrimination facing lots of minority low-income people who don't have a criminal record. Add a criminal record on top of that, and the barrier to entry goes far beyond anything that the Ryan plan would acknowledge. So I think there are a number of things you can do. One of the sort of lower tier things that I very much support, although I don't want to make it sound like it's the answer to everything, is these ban the box ideas. I think those are helpful in the sense of helping to put people on a more even playing field when they go into interviews. This is where you don't have to, where employers can't ask you right off the bat whether you have a criminal record, but that comes later in the process. I think that's useful, but I think it's a relatively small bore part of the solution. I think you're going to have to get into something I was talking about a minute ago, which is direct job creation. Mm-hmm. And it's not just a matter of, say, here's a job, good luck, go get it. I think there's going to have to be a training component to that as well. In neighborhoods where people are both facing racial discrimination and the kinds of barriers that you face when you have a criminal record, and there's also a massive shortage of jobs in some of these places. I think you know the sort of places I'm talking about. It's a Sandpoint, Baltimore, it's parts of Detroit. There you have to probably consider direct job creation to really help people find that path back into the job market.
Well, Jared Bernstein, thank you so much for walking us through this. I feel like this is a great way to kick off our show, because Paul Ryan, I think, is trying to be the central point of the poverty argument and debate. I think you expertly helped us bring him down today. But we also
I think you've been brought down before that, to be totally honest. This was a week where the media did its job.
Absolutely.
And actually took a look at what was really in the plan and what wasn't in it, as opposed to all the puff pieces that he's come to expect. I have to say, I don't think he expected to have the worst week in Washington.
Right, exactly.
He's got another problem working right now, which has to do with his relationship with the Republican candidate for president. and that kind of, he's sort of been stepping in it all week on that one.
I've been saying Absolutely. He's stuck between a rock and a hairpiece.
I couldn't wait to say that.
I couldn't wait to say it. I've been holding on to that.
On this episode, we're also going to be talking to Corey Mason, who is part of the state legislature in Wisconsin. So he'll be able to say a lot about his home state congressman and what he's doing related to poverty.
And we also have a conversation with Roach Brown. He's the host of a show called Crossroads on WPFW, and he's going to be talking a little bit about his experience spending 20 years behind bars in the criminal justice system before becoming a prison radio host who now has risen to national fame. That's part of what earned him a presidential commutation of his sentence. And he'll be talking a little bit about a radiothon that he's going to be hosting on WPFW on June 17th to raise awareness about mass incarceration and the solutions to it.
So stay tuned. And thanks again for joining us, Jared.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. With me to dig a little bit deeper, not necessarily into Ryan's plan itself, but into what folks back home in his district think about Ryan's plans on poverty, is State Representative Corey Mason. He represents Racine, Wisconsin, and his district is inside of Speaker Paul Ryan's congressional district. Representative Mason, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So just to kick us off, Paul Ryan has for a few years now been painting himself as a very serious thinker on poverty. What do his constituents back home think about that?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't really know what to make of it. I mean, for so long of the speaker's career, if you look at what he's done, particularly when he was chairing the budget committee, has been really about reducing and eliminating programs that actually help people in poverty and move people into the middle class. So when he began to talk about taking poverty seriously, and, you know, earlier this year he talked about maybe we should stop talking about takers and makers and that's not helpful. And so there was this hope before the plan was rolled out that maybe Paul Ryan's thinking on how to address poverty and getting people into the middle class had changed, and he was going to offer something substantive that would really make a difference in terms of moving people out of poverty. What we got was really more of the same from when he was on the budget committee, and really a fancy new way of repackaging these programs that people on the ground here really rely on.
So tell me a little bit about what's going on in Racine. What is the state of economic security or lack thereof that its residents are facing? And how does that play in to the policies that Paul Ryan is pushing?
Yeah, I mean, so Racine is like a lot of Midwestern towns that was big into manufacturing in the last century, that's been deindustrializing because of bad trade deals and less collective bargaining power than workers once had, that's trying to figure out how to adjust to the new economy and what that looks like. And so this was an area that for a long time had a very robust, very strong middle class with lots of factories. And really it was a place where you could graduate from high school and you'd get a union card and you go work at a factory, and you wouldn't be rich, but you'd be securely middle class and you'd be able to buy a home and hopefully send your kids to college one day. That was Racine for most of the 20th century. Now, as you know, one bad trade deal after another has occurred, Congressman Ryan's district has lost at least 10,000 jobs from these bad trade deals that have gone overseas or to other countries. So a lot of those jobs have gone away. And the jobs that they're replaced with have put Racine in a position where we have a lot of low-wage jobs, and unfortunately we have the highest unemployment in the state. So the hope that we had is that there would be a real recognition that what Congressman Ryan needed to do was acknowledge that just sort of repackaging the same old, you know, let's do trickle-down economics and maybe even give some of this money designated to the poor over to Wall Street to bond for new programming was really not at all what people were excited to hear about. It really, what Paul Ryan's saying and what he's doing to his district in terms of getting people out of poverty and helping people stay in the middle class are two very different things.
We heard earlier in the show from Jared Bernstein about how Ryan's 35-page plan is entirely silent on job creation and on boosting wages. But another topic that you don't see discussed anywhere at all in those 35 pages is unions and collective bargaining. Is that part of what you and other folks in Racine feel it would be part of the solution?
Yeah, I mean, there's really two big things that really helped Racine and the Wisconsin sort of manufacturing economy go for so long. Number one, we invested in worker training and getting people to work in a real and substantial way that gave employers the skilled workers they needed. And then workers in those factories got collective bargaining power. And so, you know, it's people often talk about manufacturing jobs paying better as though that was just sort of an accident of history, but it wasn't. It was because you had unions here in Racine, mostly the United Auto Workers, who collectively bargained and insisted that they be paid fairly for the fruits of their labor and protected on the jobs with workplace conditions. So that's all diminished in a substantial way. And without really discussing how we're going to train the workers for the skills they'll need for the jobs of the 21st century, and allowing workers a robust opportunity to bargain collectively in a real and substantial way, it's going to be hard to move the needle on not only getting people out of poverty, but even keeping people in the middle class.
And the Center for American Progress has done research that shows not just is being in a union tremendously beneficial when it comes to being able to fight for better wages and better benefits, but it also actually has an impact on people who are not in the union. So areas with higher union density are also areas of higher economic mobility and opportunity.
Right. I mean, you saw that here, you know, factory after factory, not all the factories in Racine were unionized, but the ones that weren't were forced to keep up with wages and benefits compared to the factories that were because they wanted to be able to recruit and retain workers to do that work. So, yeah, it absolutely has a positive impact. And as workers' voices have diminished, so have their pay and their benefits and their job security.
How do people in Paul Ryan's district feel when he repeats the same kind of statements that the difference between poverty and not poverty is just getting a job, and that the answer is just to require everyone to be working?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's so frustrating about what that conversation they're having there is this is also the guy who opposes raising the minimum wage so that people who have jobs aren't living in poverty. Right. So you can't have it both ways. I mean, you can't say, hey, if you want these benefits, you ought to be working and get a job, and then say, but we're not going to let you have these benefits if you're getting worker training to get that job, or we're not going to let you have benefits that accrue enough so that if you're actually working, you don't need the government to subsidize low wage employers. Right. So you really can't have it both ways. I mean, Paul Ryan, not surprisingly, he's the Speaker of the House. He's a very effective politician. So when he says these things, it sounds really good. But then when people sort of look into it and see what might be there, you know, it's the same old stuff. And, you know, you'd think with the Speaker having the city with the highest unemployment in the state for well over a decade, he'd want to do something substantial to turn it around. Unfortunately, it's just repackaging of the same trickle down right-wing ideological stuff that just hasn't worked in decades.
We joked a little bit earlier in the episode about how one of Paul Ryan's colleagues at the unveiling of this long-awaited, long-anticipated poverty plan actually referred to poor people as untapped, dormant assets.
Yeah, I mean, it's a it's an unfortunate way to refer to people, to human beings, as though they're widgets in an economic model, right? I mean, they're more than that. And, you know, Paul Ryan's plan talks about one of the bedrocks of our country being strong families. Well, if you want to have strong families, you've got to pay people decent enough wages so that they can afford to be in the middle class. And you've got to give workers a voice so that they're treated fairly in the workplace and can actually have time to spend with their families. So, you know, I think it misses the mark in a lot of really substantial ways about turning it around and getting people not just back on their feet, but if you're serious about, again, not only moving people out of poverty, but keeping what's left of the middle class in this city and this congressional district that Paul Ryan represents, this is not the way that you're going to turn it around. And in fact, I worry that it's going to make it worse, because it sounds like it's something substantial when really what it's attempting to do is kick people off of poverty plans, not get people out of poverty. And those are two very different, very important distinctions.
So one of the issues that Paul Ryan's plan does speak about is it acknowledges that we have a student debt crisis in this country, and that many young people, and actually many people who aren't so young anymore, are saddled with astronomical levels of student debt, such that they're having trouble finding their economic footing. But then the plan goes on to actually propose cutting Pell Grants, which would be a huge step backwards. Is student debt part of what you see on the ground in Racine?
Yeah, it's actually what's keeping people out of the middle class. People who were raised in middle class families went to college. I mean, look, for the better part of, you know, 60, 70 years in the country, the rule was, if you work hard in school, if you go to college, get good grades, you'll come out of college and you'll have access to a good middle class job. And what we're finding with people who now graduate from the University of Wisconsin with more than $30,000 in debt on average is there's really an effective new barrier to people staying in the middle class with this huge debt that we're asking young people to pay off on average about 20 years. So yeah, it's absolutely a barrier to people getting into staying into the middle class, because we're asking people to basically go to college, and then those colleges turn into debtors' prisons for about 20 years for people, and it's just not sustainable. I mean, look, when we invested in this country in a big way after World War II with the GI Bill and getting, we had the best educated, most competitive workforce in the world, and as we're scaling back our resources under Speaker Ryan's leadership to invest in a strong, well-educated workforce, other countries are investing. And it's a global economy, and we're now at a disadvantage to be able to compete because Speaker Ryan and his colleagues don't invest in the things that we know build a robust middle class, and it's got to change.
So one of the things in the last 2 minutes that I have with you, one of the things that Speaker Ryan has received a lot of attention for during his rebrand or turnaround on poverty has been that he went on a poverty tour. He actually traveled across the United States. It was hailed as a similar act to what we saw Bobby Kennedy do several decades ago. But he didn't go to his home district as part of that tour. How do people in Racine and throughout his district feel about what kind of attention he pays or doesn't pay to the people that he actually represents in Congress?
Yeah, I mean, I think people had a visceral reaction of, you know, Congressman Ryan trying to compare himself to Bobby Kennedy as it comes to poverty. But, I mean, look, if the congressman is looking for a substantial way to address poverty, he doesn't need to look any further than his own backyard. And I know he's a national politician now, he's Speaker of the House, and he's got lots of other duties. But, you know, if these ideas were working and were such great ideas, you know, I would have liked to have believed that they were effective here in his own home district, but they haven't been. It's the same failed policies that he's been pushing for more than a decade. And, you know, I'm afraid that he's going to try to put that same imprint that failed in his own congressional district across the country. And what makes it so cynical is he does it under the guise of saying he's trying to address poverty, when in fact what he's trying to do is dismantle poverty programs that get people out of poverty and help people get into the middle class. So, you know, from a guy sitting in Racine, Wisconsin, sitting in Paul Ryan's district, really urge him to come home and listen and see what's actually happening on the ground in terms of these policies he's pushing over and over again that have failed here and have failed the country.
I've been speaking with Corey Mason. He is a state representative who represents Racine, Wisconsin, inside of Speaker Paul Ryan's congressional district. And you can hear more from him and other constituents of Paul Ryan's in a video produced by TalkPoverty.org, which you can find on our website. Representative Mason, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with Talk Poverty Radio.
My pleasure.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. With me in studio is a very special guest, someone whose radio show I've been on, and so I'm incredibly honored to have him on Talk Poverty Radio. His name is Roger Roach Brown, better known as Roach. He is the host of a radio show called Crossroads. He also is the founder of Inner Voices, and we'll talk a little bit about what that is. Roach, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
And thank you. And first of all, Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas. I knew you were going to say that, and it warms my heart. Merry Christmas back to you.
Thank you.
So, Roach, tell us a little bit about how you came to host Crossroads, what that show is about, and how does that fit in with your own personal story?
Crossroads is a one-hour show that's broadcast weekly on WPFW Public Radio. It deals with issues of the criminal justice system with the emphasis on returning citizens. We've been doing the show for 7 years. We, meaning my wife and I, Mertine.
And she's here, too. Hi, Mertine.
Hello.
And everywhere I go, she goes with me. She has a pair of what I call gold handcuffs. So she keeps me cuffed right to her. And Crossroads is about the criminal justice system, as I said before, with emphasis on the formerly incarcerated. I was incarcerated. I've served over 30 years and 4 months, over half of my life in prison. Went in for murder. Did 12 years in. While in prison, I got injured severely in a guards riot. I was paralyzed, beaten for 3 solid days. We filed a suit against the prison system for abuse of authority, power, etc. And about in solitary for that 8 months, I've been in solitary many times, over 20, 30 times. But for some reason, this last 8 month stint was a deciding factor, and it turned my whole life around. I wrote the words Christmas in Prison in the Dust, took that and expanded into a play called Christmas in Time. And it came out of that, and I got guys that performed the play inside of prison. We put the play on. It was the first time a play was written in prison by prisoners, for prisoners, and performed for prisoners. As a result, the Washington Post and other media came in and saw the play, and folk in the community requested from the prison if they can let us out to perform it. And we were fortunate enough to be allowed out of prison while serving life 15 other guys along with myself had 30, 40, 50 years. We went out and returned, and nobody never escaped. As a result of that, we were allowed out of prison 5-6 days a week to perform in colleges, universities, schools, military bases, government agencies, the Embassy of Ghana, the United States Congress, Smithsonian Museum. We performed for everybody and everyone for 4 or 5 years in Washington. We did 500 performances outside the gates of Lawton and returned 500 times without an escape or without an incident. As a result of that, that led to the President of the United States stepping in and commuting my sentence on Christmas Day of 1975.
And which president was this?
That was Gerald Ford. As a result of that, everything good and bad happened to me happened on Christmas. I got sentenced around Christmas to life. I was injured severely and placed in solitary around Christmas. We performed a play that I wrote called Christmas in Time, and the President of the United States stepped in and granted me executive clemency, which gave me immediate parole on Christmas Day. So every day to me means Christmas.
Well, this gives me a little bit more background on why you always say Merry Christmas when you see me and anyone.
That's right.
Now
that's
I understand right. the meaning.
That's right.
So how long ago was that you received that commutation?
In 1975, I received a commutation. Since then, I was fortunate enough to get a job at Fox News, which was called Metro Media then. While in prison, before I got the commutation, Channel 5 hired me as a trainee at the TV station. I worked at the TV station 5 days a week, producing the 10 o'clock news, the 6 o'clock news, and black news. As a result of that, we were nominated for 3 Emmys. While in Lawton, while on furlough, allowed out of prison, working at the TV station, pending my executive clemency. So all this was going on while we were waiting on the President of the United States to intercede. And he interceded and granted me a pardon. But for 4 years, I was on what's called indefinite furlough from prison while serving life. And we produced plays, the TV show, and in the evening or night, I would return to the prison and come back out the next morning and do my plays and television show. This went on for 4 years. In fact, just before that, we performed on the floor of the U.S. Senate with Senator Ed Brooke, who was one of our main sponsors. And as a result of that, we've been going all over the country. We were allowed out of prison to perform nationally. We performed at New York, California, several other states, and returned from these trips back to prison. So we were the only prison group that not only was allowed out locally, we were allowed out nationally, and we performed around the country and came back to prison. So as a result of that, we did a few movies, a few television shows. We were nominated for, we won the New York Film Festival. The International Film Festival was nominated twice at the Cannes Film Festival for plays and movies that we were involved in. As a result of that, we ran the first restitution program in the country in conjunction with the Justice Department. I ran community-based programs for returning citizens, juveniles as mentoring programs. So for the past 41 years, we've been involved in a wide range of social, community, political activities. We worked for the mayor in Washington. We got the law passed in 79 that gave ex-offenders or returning citizens the right to vote. We were one of the first states or jurisdictions in the country that had restored the right of returning citizens to vote. So we got that right in 79 in D.C., and when Marion Barry got arrested and he came back out in the early 90s, we sat down and talked to Marion and said that you passed the law or you signed the law when he first came in 1979, and this was like in 92. He came back out and we reminded him that this law was passed and he signed it. So we got together, we mobilized, organized, and strategized the returning citizens community in Washington, D.C., which played a substantial role in him getting reelected back to the office of mayor. Consequently, he appointed me as a special assistant to the mayor, and I created the Office of Ex-Offender Affairs, which is now called the Office of Returning Citizens. We also created the Office of Ex-Offender Employment at the Department of Employment Services, which is now called Project Empowerment. And it's it is a warm feeling inside to know that we've had a part in creating so many things in this city. We don't want the credit. We ain't pushing for the credit. The credit goes to them people who made that decision to make these services available for those men and women who need them. So we've been spending our time making sure that we can help assist removing obstacles, eliminating restrictions, to making sure men and women and kids who come out can get the right to earn a living and take care of their families. And that's all this is about, taking care of your families, making a living, and be able to hold your head up. While sitting here waiting to do this interview, I was sitting in the lobby, me and my wife, and I saw so many young people coming by. And I can see the spark in their steps. They got a sparkle in their eye. They're earning a living. They're taking care of their loved ones or their families. And that is a sparkle that everybody should have, the sparkle of knowing I get a check every 2 weeks and I can pay my bills, I can take my kids out and take my wife out. That means so much to so many people.
So taking the story from founding Inner Voices and traveling nationally with that troupe and doing theater and working on film and media, how did you come then to host a radio show?
When I was in Lorton back in the 70s before I got to Parton, I was invited to appear on WPFW. I went there several times, and when I came out, I had a show in the 70s on PFW called Inside Outside. While in prison, I convinced them or talked to them about giving me an opportunity to do a show about prison and prisoners. And I'm still in prison on furlough waiting on my executive clemency. And I was working at PFW as a radio host for about 6 months or 9 months. This was like in the 70s, back in the 70s, mid-70s. So I've always had an opportunity. And one of the ways that happened, I go and knock on the door and say, can I do something? They said, well, you know, whatever the baggage is I was carrying, that didn't matter. I said, you need me and I can do something and I can make a contribution. So they gave me a shot. Then a friend of mine who was in Inner Voices who died, named Archie Childs, was working at PFW doing a show called Crossroads. And when Archie passed away, I went to his funeral. We talked to the producers and them, and they said, would you be willing to assume Archie's show? Certainly. They said, we can call it, I'm not going to change it. Don't call it Roche Brown Show. Mm-hmm. It's Crossroads. Mm-hmm. We all are at a crossroads in our life. And I liked Archie. He was one of my actors in Inner Voices. And I keep the name Crossroads in honor of Archie Childs, who started the show. You know what I mean? It's not Roche Brown Show. It's Crossroads. And we all are at crossroads many times in the various stages of our lives, and this crossroads is very significant. Whether you're at the crossroads of marriage, financial stability, or instability, whatever, you're at a crossroads, and a lot of times it depends on your attitude, what avenue or what road you would take. And if you take the right positive, constructive attitude, no matter what happens, you'll be on the right road.
And your show focuses on criminal justice issues, issues mm-hmm. to do with the criminal justice system. A lot of the people who listen are actually in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about, you know, some of the experiences that you've had hosting this show and what makes it different from what else is on the radio out there.
You know, ironically, most of the people listening to our show are not in prison. In fact, it blew our mind. We got the demographics the other day, and the demographics for WPFW in this area is 2.4 million. We've gotten calls from professors at universities who use our show to get to their students, and they take our show, dissect it, take it apart, and they play the various characters. We get letters from prisons and jails who take Crossroads, and the inmates inside the jails would make it mandatory that the other inmates in the cell block listen to Crossroads. They, in turn, take the show apart. Somebody played me. Somebody played you, Rebecca.
After I was
on
your
show. That's right.
Makes me wonder how that went.
So the show has been received all over. We got last month, we had an interview with Canadian Broadcast Television. They came in and filmed this. 3 months before that, people came in from the UK, from the, what is his name? What was the president of England? Winston Churchill. The Winston Churchill Foundation had a fellowship program, and they sent folk over to interview us for our show. We, for some reason, because of reentry and the number of people in prison, prison is becoming a hot topic issue. So we've been getting phone calls from around the world, from the Maldives, from London, from wherever, about people want to interview us or do a copy or video we tape our show. So it's very informative, and we're getting an extremely wide listening audience. And again, you'd be more than surprised than we are. More people who listen to our show are white. We go to Silver Spring, Montgomery County. We go to Virginia. We could be in line at a Safeway. And I say something to my wife. I said, baby, what about someone? And somebody, an old lady, tapped me on the shoulder. Are you on the radio? So I said, why are you asking me that, miss? She said, because you sound very familiar. You sound like a guy named Roach. A week don't go by that we don't meet people from all walks of life. Congressmen call, judges call, senators call, people from prison. We don't know why. But anybody say they listen to Crossroads, we ask one question, why? Why do you listen to the show? And based on what the answer is, it tells us what we're doing or not doing and what we need to do to improve it. It's not an egotistical kind of thing. It's an informational piece. I want to know, are we effective? Can we reach people? Are we coming across? Are we doing the service? And if we are, fine. And we do not get paid one penny for doing this.
So I'm struck that back in the 70s when you were touring and performing prison theater out in communities, a lot of the people who were watching your plays might not have ever met someone who had been in prison at the time. Mm-hmm. We're in a very different situation today now that we've got 2.3 million Americans behind bars, one-third of Americans have some type of criminal record, half of all kids now have a parent with a criminal record. Very, very different situation now on sort of the back end of our nation's failed experiment with mass incarceration, mm-hmm. where now pretty much everyone has been touched in some way by the criminal justice system. Do you think that that plays into why your show today might actually appeal more broadly than something, you know, four decades ago?
I think that's a noticeable impact from something like that. But you mentioned earlier that there was 2.2 million people in prison. And we've been saying on our show that's not correct. There's 2.2 million in prison serving 1 year or longer in prison. But on any given day in America, there's over 800,000 to 1 million people in state and county jails and detention facilities. So that's another million. So it's more than 2.2.
That's right.
It's three something. But I don't know why they've been not revealing this other information, because we're talking about the 2.2 is people who are serving 1 year to life or death. And for the folk who haven't been sentenced, haven't been convicted, they're not counted. But yet it's 800,000 to a million. So we're talking 3 million people in prison on any given day.
And when you look over the course of a year, you actually find that about 12 million Americans cycle in and out of local jails.
You're absolutely right.
So that's a lot more people.
There you go.
So is part of what you're trying to do with the show to break down some of the us and them mentality, that it's only something that happens to other people?
Well, I'm glad you said that. And it is. It's to break down that misconception that it's only them or it's not us. Anybody can go to jail. They can indict anybody for anything. And you see it every day. Like the other day, it's in the paper about this kid in California who went to Stanford, got the rape charge. And the judge sentenced him to 6 months. He raped a student, raped a young lady, violently raped her. And his father said that 20 minutes, a 20-minute act should not judge the rest of his life. He should not be destroyed or have his life destroyed for what he did in 20 minutes. And then 3 years before that, a guy in Texas, a young white kid, killed four people in his car. He got probation for four murders. And we know that there's a different standard, there's a different class system in America. There's a different law for whites, there's a different law for black. And I'm 72 years old, and I've been dealing with this criminal justice system since I was 6, 7 years old. I've been dealing with it for 45 to 48 years, and I have seen this from ways that people haven't seen it. Seen it from the inside, from the outside. I've ran programs. I've been the victim of racism, discrimination. I've been shot, stabbed, solitary, received life, placed in a insane asylum for 3 years. And I've been going through all this stuff. And this all started when I said, when the guard called me the N-word in Lawton in 1964. Mm. And I said, I'm going to take that. I already had life. I was never coming home. And I'm not going to stay here for the rest of my life and be insulted. You already got me, so just kill me. So we got into a thing, and we started having an inmate council. And that inmate council put me in touch with my understanding that the laws don't apply equally to everybody. It depends on who you know, who you can get to, how much money you have. I don't care what crime you commit. If you get to the right person, you do not go to jail. And when I was inside, and I seen people who were just innocent, little young kids who got caught up in it. And I know them. You got a little 12, 13-year-old kid in there, and he looks like he's 8 or 9. This kid's life is going to be destroyed for the rest of his life. And you see them little kids, and you can't help them. You put them in solitary, and I go by and look at these little kids. They're like babies. They may be 9, 10, 11, but you look in their face, you see the 4-year-old or 3-year-old kid that your mother had played with, and they look at you like, Mr., please, get me out of this. You go to prison or jail to serve time for committing a crime, not to lose your mind. And when you lose your mind, very, 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 very few people. I am extremely fortunate that I got my mind. Not that I got a pardon or a commutation that got out. That I was able to recapture my mind. And if you lose that, you lose you. You don't know who you are. When I see people who lose their mind, you don't know what to do. You can't help them. You want to save their life. But I'm in the same boat, and the guards don't care. And I've never seen, Rebecca, this level of viciousness, meanness. I've been a bad guy in my life. I broke a lot of laws, did things I wasn't supposed to do. But I never intentionally, viciously hurt somebody just because I had the authority or power to. And when you see folk who abuse their authority unjustly on little kids or folk who are helpless, that's a terrible kind of meanness that I'm not used to. I don't like seeing it. And it just hurts beyond hurt. It hurts deeply. When I mean deeply, nuclear deep. It hurts in the bottom of your digestive system. And you can't get it out. You can't defecate it out. You can't eliminate it. That kind of hurt and pain is going on all across America. And one of the things that yesterday we did a show on Muhammad Ali. And I admire him for what he said in the 70s. When he won the Olympic gold medal as a heavyweight champion of the world, he fought people from all over the world. And he came back with his gold medal and his flag. He came to Louisville, Kentucky, and he couldn't go in a restaurant to eat. So he took the medal and threw it in the Ohio River. Then a few years later, they went and grabbed him and inducted him into the services. And he refused to go into armed service because he said, didn't no Vietnamese do nothing to me. Why should I go over there and help fight to make them free and get them democracy, and I don't have it here? This is not fair and it's not right. And why should I go fight for people who don't want to stand up for me? You know, and when you see stuff like it, it hurts. We all are Americans. I don't care about no color. Sure, I'm black, you're white, so what? But we're human beings. When I do my radio show and everybody said, and I talk every day on my show, I give thanks to my beautiful wife. She's beautiful not because of the way she looked. It's inside. When you're a human being and you treat people as a human being and you treat as a human being, to me, that's what it's about. Be a human being. We're people. Everybody wants to be treated as a human being. That's all. I don't care what color you are. I want to take care of my family. I want to be able to take my kids to McDonald's, take my wife to the store. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to do that. And this is all we are trying to act. We're asking for.
And in the last minute that I have you for, and I wish we could do this all day, Roach, because you're an inspiring person to speak with, and you have an amazingly inspiring story. One of the things that you're doing to raise awareness about issues about the criminal justice system is you are using your radio platform to host what you're calling a radiothon. And this is coming up next week. That's part of why we wanted to have you on the show, was so our listeners could learn about this. Tell us in this last minute, what is this radiothon and how can folks participate?
Folks can participate by calling in to the Radiothon. It's June 17th from 12 noon to 6 p.m. at WPFW, 1990 K Street. The call letters are 89.3 FM. You can go to WPFW.org and download it, live stream it from your internet. This came about as a result. We went to the White House about 6 weeks ago. I mean, five weeks ago. On a clemency conference. And as a result of that, we met people from all over the country who've been pardoned and commuted. The sentence was commuted by President Obama. We met folks from the White House, the Justice Department, the State Department. Every federal government agency was a part of this reentry conference in the White House. As a result of that, we decided, Nikichi Taifa, the young lady from the Open Society, who helped coordinate this, we got together and said, let's do a national radiothon. It's never been a radiothon. There's always been a telethon for muscular dystrophy, for polio, et cetera. But a radiothon on criminal justice. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about all the suggestions. It's twofold. To focus on the effects of mass incarceration on people that's incarcerated and its impact on families. But also we want to highlight the issue of executive clemency. The president don't have a few months left in office. We wanted to expedite this and come up with some suggestions and ask our listeners for suggestions and ideas that we can make to the president. There's other things he can do to let people out other than executive clemency. He can use a compassionate release. He can use the furlough program. He can use the seniors program. There's other programs. He made a commitment to let out 80,000 people. And right now there's only 360 that's been granted executive clemency, and he got less than 7 months. It's an impossibility to reach that number at the pace he's going. So we're saying there's other things he can do. So we have a national show. There are five radio stations connected to WPFW, a network. They're in California, San Francisco, Houston, New York, and D.C. We have 180 radio station affiliates that be a part of this. So we're looking at a potential listening market of 30 to 50 million people that will listen to this radiothon. We want people to call in. The phone number is 202-588-0893. You can call in, participate on the discussion. This will be the first time that we're having the White House supposed to be involved. There's a possibility that we might have a surprise guest attend or call in. But the bottom line is, this is galvanizing the community nationally, not just locally. We have organizations calling in from all over the country wanting to be a part of this six-hour radiothon on criminal justice for June 17th from 12 noon to 6 p.m.
Roach Brown is my guest today on Talk Poverty Radio. He is the host of Crossroads, WPFW. Roach, it's an honor to have you on, and thank you so much for joining the show.
And Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas to you. We'll have to have you back soon.
Me and Santa Claus.
That's right.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the We Act Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.